I made friends pretty early in the game with Dr. David Perlmutter, a neurologist down in Naples. And many of you have heard of Dr. Perlmutter's work. He's been on the educational television channels with his show about grain brain. And he's come out with a number of books, including Grain Brain and the Better Brain book, and now the Grain Brain cookbook, and soon to come, Brain Maker. And I shared a lot of patience with Dr. Perlmutter. If I had a client who had Parkinson's or MS or had had a stroke or we suspected of some sort of memory default, I would ask him to boogie on down to Naples and see Dr. Perlmutter. And when Perlmutter first came out with the notion that, well, not a notion, I guess that's a disrespectful way to say it, but when he sifted through the data and really saw that too many carbohydrates in the diet could affect not only your blood sugar, but could affect your brain, it was kind of hard to get on board. You know, we have gone through so many changes in nutritional science. And I think it's one of the reasons that nutritional science is not regarded in the same way that it might have been, because the early dietary science changed. You know, I've said it many times here on No Nonsense Nutrition. Monday eggs were good for you, and Tuesday eggs would kill you, and Wednesday eggs were good for you again. And I'm here to tell you they've always been good for you, and especially the yolks. We should have been throwing away the whites all these years. Not only do eggs not have anything to do with your cholesterol level, but they're just one of the most perfect foods that occurs in nature. Why do you think we grow animals out of it, not just human babies, but all babies? And so early dietary science, you know, it went way back. I mean, it goes back into the 1700s, in the 1800s, when William Banting, you know, this guy was a coffin maker. And he wrote a letter on corpulence addressed to the public, and he described a diet for weight control by giving up bread and butter and milk and sugar and beer and potatoes. And he was the very first one that saw, because he was putting everybody in the coffin as an undertaker, that obesity really created a big problem as far as health is concerned. So I clearly remember it in the 1970s, where we shifted gears and we said, oh, margarine is better for you than butter. And you know, the problem is the fats. The fats are what are giving us heart disease. The fats are what are causing high blood pressure. You know, you eat fat, you get fat. You eat fat, it, you know, lodges into your arteries. And now we know that none of that is true. We don't just have to go back to the origin of agriculture, because remember, Homo sapiens, you know, we've been here for a couple hundred thousand years. And what's true is that we ate what we could find. We ate what we could catch. And we did that for a really long period of time. For about 190,000 years, we ate eggs. We ate small birds and lizards and, you know, stuff that we could manage to catch. And we ate, you know, all of humankind evolved around a coastline. And so we ate the oysters and mussels and scallops and crabs and little fishes that caught in the tidal pool. There is fairly direct archaeological and fossil evidence on nutrition. You know, at the point that all humans subsisted on hunting and gathering, or really hunting and scavenging. You know, a large carnivore would kill a zebra and leave a little bit behind, and, you know, we'd scavenge it. Some of that archaeological and fossil evidence indicates that humans evolved on vegetarian diets, just the same as other great apes. You know, it's hard for us to grab into that evolution sometimes, but what's true is the great apes are vegetarian for the most part. And then they moved into some meat eating. Relatives of Homo sapiens, such as the Neanderthals, were almost exclusively carnivorous, exclusively meat eaters. But if we look at the contemporary hunter-gatherers, they have a diet that's relatively low in carbohydrates. The animal food-centered diet is definitely preferred in the contemporary hunter-gatherers. Because, you see, you couldn't have been a grain eater, you couldn't have been a bean eater unless you were able to cook it. And so everybody talks about the fact that until we established agriculture, we didn't have grains and beans in the diet. But what they forget to mention is we didn't have grains and beans in the diet until we had pottery, because we had to have something, we had to have a vessel to cook it in. You know, you can roast a rabbit on a spit over a fire easily, but you can't cook a grain over a fire. And so as these grasses, these seeds, these legumes began to become available, we quit being hunter-gatherer scavengers. We found a place we liked and we stayed there and we created a village. And for the most part, people stayed in one place, because you had to stay in one place if you were going to plant something in the ground, protect it from other critters that wanted to eat it until you were able to harvest it. And then you had to have some place to store it. And then you had to be able to cook it. And so that meant that we weren't just wandering around going from one food source to another food source. When we look at the background of evolving as hunter-gatherer scavengers, mostly we were gatherers. We ate what we could find. We ate leaves. We ate tubers. We ate those small animals. We ate the eggs. There wasn't very much fruit around, and if there was fruit around, it was seasonal. It was really short-lived. You know, most trees are going to be able to be harvested over a couple of week period of time, and of course, you're fighting the birds and everything else for them. I learned that when I was living in Sedona, and I had my very first cherry tree, because growing up as a Florida kid, I'd never had cherries off a tree or peaches and nectarines and apples off a tree. And so I remember when I had to net the tree to keep the birds off of it so that I could enjoy the cherries. So even if you ate fruit, it was seasonal and it was short-lived. We didn't have a grocery store we could walk into 365 days a year and buy anything that we wanted to. So we probably had a really diverse diet as we evolved, but it was a really diverse diet that was based on the calendar. Depending on the latitude that you lived in, you know, you might have eaten mangoes in June and July, but, you know, if you were 15 degrees further north on the continent, you never ate a mango because it wasn't one around for 300 miles. You know, you might have eaten a crab apple, you know, those little ping pong ball size apples, you know, they're not very sweet. This is definitely not the Harry and David stuff. So, yeah, we had some fruit in the diet, but we didn't have very much, and we didn't have it for very long, and we just had it seasonally. So if we look at the evolution of the diet in humans, what we see is, number one, is variety, huge amounts of variety, and the second thing that we see is plenty and then absence of food. It was feast or famine. You know, you found that mango tree, you ate mangoes till you couldn't eat any more mangoes, and then the next day you might not have any food. It wasn't like you had a backpack to throw it into. So the body developed ways to survive feast and famine. It was something we called the thrifty gene. The thrifty gene enabled us to pack on pounds when we had lots of food available, and then live off some of that stored fat when there was famine, when there was a lack of resources. But once we started forming villages and we started growing things and harvesting things and fundamentally staying in one place, or maybe having being bi-housal, you know, having one village that was up the mountain when it was the summertime and one village that was down the mountain in the wintertime, because we followed the primary herds that we used as food sources. But we didn't really have grains. We didn't really have beans in the diet until about 10,000 years ago. And 10,000 years sounds like a really long time, but you know what? Since it takes 40 to 70,000 years for genes to change, that isn't really very long. Well, what we've turned into are major carb eaters. And after the 1970s, when we made fat the bad guy, we said that fat had to do with cholesterol, even though all of that has been refuted. What we found out was that we're just getting too blinking many carbohydrates. And what it's affecting are our rates of diabetes and our rates of dementia. Now, I don't know anybody who wants to raise their hand when I say who wants diabetes and who wants dementia. And remember, if you have diabetes, your risk of dementia is exactly doubled. And if you're an insulin-dependent diabetic, it goes up fourfold. Those aren't really good odds. And especially when we realize that at 85 years old, half of everybody that is alive at 85 years old has Alzheimer's disease. These are pretty ugly stats. And, you know, Alzheimer's disease costs more in terms of health care than heart disease and cancer and all the accidents put together. $200 billion for the last year that we have numbers available. But we sit down with a bowl of sweetened cereal, frosted something or other, sugar something or others, a bowl of sugar bombs, the single least expensive thing that a company can make the greatest profits on. We sit down and eat that bowl of cereal. It's the American way. And of course, we have it with a glass of orange juice, and we have it with a piece of toast with jelly on it. And we're starting our day with a candy bar and a piece of cake. We have turned into carb heads. We have put in so many carbohydrates in our diet that we have doubled the rate of diabetes in this country between 1997 and 2007. Doubled. Well, you know, in the study of nutrition, and if you're a regular listener to No Nonsense Nutrition, then you've heard some of these things before. We talk about the word essential. The word essential doesn't just mean that you have to have it. You have to have 27 vitamins and minerals in order to keep the body going. Those 27 are de rigueur. You have to have them. You're missing any one of those, then function is not going to be optimal. But when we talk about essential, we talk about essential fatty acids, EFAs, essential fatty acids. You know, you've heard of them, omega-3s, omega-6s, they're essential. The word essential means it has to come off your plate. It doesn't just mean it's important. It means it has to come off your plate. Your body can't make it. So when we talk about essential fatty acids, remember the wall of every cell in your body is made out of fat, and 50% of that is saturated fat, by the way. 70% of the weight of your brain is fat. So essential fatty acids are critical. And people went on these low-fat diets, no-fat diets. They're buying all these low-fat, no-fat things. I mean, how many pounds did America gain drinking diet soda and eating snack wells? When we went to a low-fat diet, we substituted those calories with high carbs. And look where it got us. America's health has deteriorated markedly in the last 40 years. But essential fatty acids, we know they're important. We know we have to get them off the plate. Essential amino acids. Of those 20 amino acids, 8 of them have to come off your plate, 10 if you're a child. Those 8 essential amino acids make the other 12. They turn into the other 12 in the process in the body. So you could suppose that if you only ate those 8, you're actually getting 20, because those 8 will turn into the other 12. But if you ate the 12, the non-essential amino acids, they don't change in anything else. You would still be protein deficient. So we know we have essential fatty acids. We know we have essential amino acids, but we don't have any essential carbohydrates. They don't exist. Body can live completely without carbohydrates. You know, the first ketogenic diet, the diet that took the carbohydrates out, was used with people who had seizures, and the seizures stop. So in the 1990s, when Dr. Atkins published The New Diet Revolution and other doctors began to publish books based on the same principle, this is what the mass media call the low-carb craze in the United States, Atkins was poo-pooed. He was laughed and hooted at because he said we were just getting too many Krispy Kremes. We were just getting too many bad fats. That we needed to get better quality fats. And so now that the paleo diet has become popular, and I've asked, you know, six so-called experts what the paleo diet is, and I get six different answers, but they continue to put forward the idea that humans evolved fundamentally on meat, but the anthropological evidence is that that's not true, that yes, there were meats and other animal proteins that were in the diet, but we certainly didn't evolve on meat. There is a lot of information in terms of the fossil and archaeological record that shows that we had all of these plant foods in the diet. So now that the paleo diet is popularized and people say, well, you're just going to take out these certain foods. You're going to make sure that you have grass-fed meat. Because remember, grass-fed meat, you know, cows out on the field, the way that they evolve, they've got nice omega-3s in their fats. They have some of those essential fats in there. When we talk about those high-quality meats, they're not, you know, on a feedlot. I mean, think about it. How do you fatten up a cow? You feed them corn. You feed them soybeans. You know, you want to get fattened up like a cow? Go ahead. Live on corn and soybeans. We can eat fish and seafood. We can eat some fresh fruit, small amounts, in season. We can eat all the non-starchy vegetables. We can have eggs. We can have nuts. And remember, that doesn't include peanuts because peanuts are a bean. They're a legume. They grow under the ground. They don't grow on a tree like a nut does. We can eat seeds. We can have all those healthy oils like olive oil and walnut oil and macadamia oil and avocado oil and coconut oil. I still got a question about flax oil. I'm not particularly a fan of flax oil. I'm a big fan of flax seeds, but not a fan of flax oil. We can have a little bit of unrefined honey and real maple syrup, a little bit on occasion. But the foods that aren't considered paleo are any grains at all. It doesn't matter whether it's gluten-containing grains like wheat and rye and barley or non-gluten-containing grains like oats and quinoa and rice. Any legumes, of course, including peanuts. Dairy products are out. Because, again, unless you were agriculturally based and living in a village, you didn't have a goat or a sheep or a yak or a llama, certainly not a cow, to milk and have cheese and yogurt, much less ice cream. What's not paleo are all sugars and all of the starchy vegetables, you know, from potatoes to parsnips. And processed food of any kind, you know, if it doesn't come from the land, it's not paleo. Overly salty foods, refined vegetable oils. No palm oil, no sunflower oil, no canola oil, one of the genetically modified crops. But, you know, there's still a piece that's missing in this story. And the piece that's missing in this story is the realization that we're eating carbs to beat the band. Not only are we having that bowl of sugar bombs for breakfast with a glass of orange juice and a piece of toast with jelly on it, we're going to lunch and having french fries and a big gulp along with the bun on our cheeseburger. And then we're snacking on pretzels in the afternoon with our diet soda, which now has been definitively demonstrated to increase insulin insensitivity. And then we go to dinner and have a plate of pasta and, you know, have a roll with it. And then have a sweetened dessert. And so when we look at one out of two people at age 85 who have Alzheimer's, one out of five people at age 70, those are pretty scary stats. When we look at diabetes and what diabetes does in terms of kidney damage, in terms of damage to the eyeball, in terms of damage to the nerves, we got a reason to look at that total carbohydrate amount in the diet and say we should be eating less. Carbohydrate, C-H-O, carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. H-O, you know what that means, H2O, it's water. You take carbon and you hydrate it. You hook eight water molecules onto a carbon molecule and you have a carbo from carbon, hydrate from water. Every one of the carbohydrates that goes in your body, it doesn't matter if it's a sip of orange juice or it's a bite of a candy bar, has to be metabolized within the cell with vitamin B1, vitamin B2, and vitamin B3, thiamine, riboflavin, and niacin. If you don't have enough thiamine, riboflavin, and niacin, you can't process carbohydrate. Well, fats are just made out of carbon and hydrogen. The oxygen is off of there. There's just a little teeny tiny teeny, remember Roseanne, Rosanna, Dana? Teeny, 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 tiny amount of oxygen in a fat. So all I have to do is cleave off that oxygen, and I can take that CHO and turn it into a CH and store it as fat. We don't get fat eating fat. We get fat eating carbs. We don't get fat eating fat. We get fat eating carbs. Why did I say it twice? Because I'm trying to make the point. Not only that, that's what raises our cholesterol. Eating cholesterol doesn't raise cholesterol. In fact, when you eat cholesterol, your liver has to make less of it. Your liver makes 2,000 milligrams of cholesterol every day. And so yesterday I had three egg yolks. And I have three egg yolks, about 300 milligrams of cholesterol in each egg yolk. So I get 900 milligrams of cholesterol, then my liver gets a vacation. It only has to make 1,100 milligrams of cholesterol because I already took it in dietarily. Your body'd much rather make the cholesterol show up on the plate than have to manufacture it in the liver. But we know darn good and well that what raises cholesterol are trans fats, those nasty, processed, cheap oils that people use in baked goods to make them last forever. Remember the rule. If it goes bad, it's good for you. If it never goes bad, it's bad for you. If you've got that box of crackers on the shelf that you can will to your grandkids because they're never going to go bad, they're trouble. Fruits and vegetables rot. Dairy products go rancid. Meat putrefies. If it goes bad, that's good. So when we look at this high carbohydrate diet that we have, what is it doing? Well, first off, it's giving us high blood pressure because hydrate, think about it, one of the things it does is create water retention. I've told the story on here before about the client who called us up. It said, I be swole. She was a lady that grew up in the South, and she had too much sodium in the meal the night before, and she be swole. But part of her being swole is the water retention that comes from excess amount of carbohydrates. What's the very first thing that a lot of docs do when they're treating high blood pressure? They put you on HCTZ, hydrochlorothiazide. HCTZ is a diuretic. We're squeezing out the water because the water is squeezing the blood vessels and driving the blood pressure up. We reduce the total amount of carbohydrate in the diet. We lower the blood pressure. It's not just the effect of carbohydrates on blood sugar. It's also the effects of carbohydrate on insulin insensitivity. When we blast the body with sugar day after day after day after day, the receptors on the surface of the cell wall, they can't take it. They can't take that much sugar, so they unmake some of the receptors. the insulin doesn't work as good, so you have to have more insulin. That's why when you get your blood sugar tested, don't just test your fasting glucose, test your fasting insulin. Fasting insulin should be de rigueur. It should be automatic that it gets tested at the same time. Very few docs are doing it. If your insulin number is high, 5, 10, even higher, 27 is one I saw a couple of weeks ago, where do we want it? We want 2s and 4s because that says you're keeping your blood sugar under control. And so not only do we become insulin insensitive, which in turn leads to diabetes. And by the way, there is no such thing as pre-diabetes any more than there's any such thing as pre-hypertension. That is just absolute nonsense. Pre-diabetes means you're walking the plank already. Pre-hypertension means you're hanging 10 off the end of the board. And congestive heart failure. You know, one of the really interesting stats you can look at is that as America has continued to take more and more and more statin drugs, one of the absolute tickets to dementia, in my opinion, Lipitor, A Thief of Memory, is Duane Graveline's book, and a really important book if you're somebody who's taken statin drugs. When we look at the increase in statins, we look at the increase in congestive heart failure at the same rate. You know the gal that can't walk across the parking lot because she's out of breath? That congestive heart failure in part comes from that water retention. Not only that, that high carbohydrate drives down your white blood cells. You drive down your white blood cells, you catch everything. You get every cold. Every scratch gets infected. Plus, that high carbohydrate diet fuels cancer. Cancer's metabolism is such that it can only use sugar in order to thrive, and it becomes addictive. How many times in practice have I heard somebody say, I eat something, and 20 minutes later, I got to eat something again, and 20 minutes later, I got to eat. I just have an eat-a-thon the whole night. From the time I get home from work until the time I go to bed is just one big eat-a-thon. If you came home and had a couple deviled eggs or ate a couple chicken legs, you find out it wouldn't be so easy. So when we begin to look at this really high carbohydrate diet and realize that it contributes to inflammation, and inflammation is really the silent killer. Inflammation is the foundation of darn near everything that hurts us. Remember, the thing that's going on in medicine today, you know, when we talk about functional medicine and complementary medicine and integrative medicine, we're talking about the concept of wellness. We're not talking about having a 4-minute appointment and getting to the diagnosis as quickly as you can so you can code it so you can get paid by insurance. That's acute medicine. You know, if you put a stick in your eye, have a car wreck, need a heart valve replaced, need a knee operated on, you want to be in America. We are fabulous at crash and bang work. We are lousy at what kills us, which is chronic illness. When we begin to look at the nature of functional medicine, working on these chronic illnesses, it's about giving you empowering information. That's what this show is all about. That's why when you go up on Podomatic and you type in my name or you type in Plews News, there's 200 of, at least, of the radio shows that I've done here at WSLR over the last 9+ years that I've been on the air. It's empowering information. And it can tell us that these higher blood sugar levels that come from eating too many carbohydrates can do all these gnarly things to us. They can set us on a road to type 2 diabetes. They can set us on a road to Alzheimer's, to congestive heart failure, to high blood pressure. That's a lousy list. My favorite death is the one that happened to a client whose 108-year-old father was picking olives off his olive tree and fell off the ladder and broke his neck. It's a beautiful story, 108. So when we look at this indelible link between blood sugar levels and brain health, we can look a year ago at the New England Journal of Medicine study that clearly showed that cognitive function was directly correlated to the risk of dementia and the level of blood sugar. Higher average blood sugar levels within the preceding 5 years were statistically significant for an increased risk of dementia. This held true whether people started with diabetes or not. So an important part of keeping your brain on cue as you age is that you don't just want to have good blood sugar control, you want to have excellent, total control. And the way that you can achieve that is to cut back on your carbs, including sugar, including things that contain starch. You know, starch is a plant's way of storing energy, just like fat is the human way of storing energy. You know, we always talk about carbon sequestration with the issue of global heating. Because if you saw the stats in last week's paper, 2014 is the hottest year on record that have been being kept since 1880. So in the last 135 years, we've never had a year as hot as 2014. And remember, the East Coast, we didn't really feel it, but they sure did feel it in the West last year. So one of the things they say will sequester carbon, help to get the carbon out of the air, is to plant more trees. And so when we plant trees, the trees take up some of that carbon from the air, sequester carbon. Well, that's what we're doing when we get fat. We're storing carbon. When we realize that when you cut back on your starches, the way that these plants are storing fuel in the breads and the pastas and the potatoes and all like that, and make a healthy substitution for these foods, substitutions that are just as tasty and satisfying, but are more non-starchy vegetables. So you're having mixed greens, and there's more bell peppers on your plate, and there's more big salads, and there's nuts and seeds used, and there's sautéed spinach with, you know, a little bit of scallions in it, and a little toasted pumpkin seeds on top. We're going to make a change. We're going to make a change for the better. Well, you know, I grew up in Florida. Florida's the orange state. You know, Florida sunshine in a glass. You know, start that day with a great big glass of orange juice. A 12-ounce can of soda pop, 36 grams of sugar. A 12-ounce glass of orange juice, 36 grams of sugar. That's 9 teaspoons. 9 teaspoons of sugar, 3 tablespoons of sugar is what you find in a 12-ounce can of soda or a 12-ounce glass of orange juice, either one. And that's before you have the toast with the jelly on it and the bowl of whole grain cereal. Oh, don't forget, throw a banana on top. And maybe it's whole wheat toast. I used to be a fan. You know, my mother is the one that told me that a good loaf of bread holds open a door in a storm, so, you know, you had to have that, you know, hearty loaf of bread to hold the door open in a storm. Now, I know it's just too much carbs. So let's be reasonable. Let's be reasonable and first off, get out the gluten. You know I've done other shows on getting out the gluten. You know, the wheat, the rye, the barley, the spelt, and the kamut. And if you're not a health food shopper, you probably don't see spelt and kamut too often. They're non-hybridized sources of wheat, old sources, or farro, the new popular grain. All gluten-containing grains. Corn has gluten, but it's of a different type. Oats have gluten, but it's of a different type. But, you know, a lot of oats are contaminated with gluten because they're processed in the same factory. So when you buy oats, you got to make sure that there's a declarative on the package that says processed in a factory that doesn't produce oats. But when we begin to look to reduce that total volume of carbs, we're going to put in a few more fats. In the next show, I'm going to talk more about those fats. Because New England Journal of Medicine, you know, ran a study and they looked at the low-fat diet and they looked at the low-carb diet and they looked at the Mediterranean diet. Mediterranean diet is like the low-carb diet where it emphasizes healthy fats from olive oil and fish and nuts and seeds. But it does allow for more carbs through whole grains. The low-carb in the Mediterranean diet showed the greatest weight loss. in the study that was in the New England Journal of Medicine, 12 pounds and 10 pounds respectively. Turns out that the low-fat diet, people didn't lose weight. In fact, the people on the low-fat diet who consumed the highest level of carbohydrates had no change in their triglycerides. Well, the drop in triglycerides for those on the high-fat, low-carb diet was 10 times greater. Triglycerides are a gnarly chemical. They contribute to cardiovascular disease. So when you look at your lipid panel, your cholesterol, your HDL, your LDL, you see triglycerides there. Average lab will show 150 is the top end of triglycerides. But what's true is you don't really even want it over 100. Because that's energy. That's fuel in your body. You want it going into the cell where it can be used as fuel. You don't want it floating around in your bloodstream where that sticky stuff can interact with the walls of the artery. But the thing that's most important about that study in the New England Journal of Medicine was that it showed that this biomolecule called C-reactive protein, which is a notable marker for inflammation, was lowered only in the people who ate the most fat. You know, that's pretty compelling evidence. In 2012, Mayo Clinic published, and they showed that the risk of dementia was reduced by 44% in people eating a high-fat, low-carb diet compared to the ones who ate the lowest level of fat. Those favoring the most carbs in their diet had an 89% increase in their risk for dementia. But remember, not all fats are created equal. And being fat is not a good thing. You shouldn't be eating any trans fats. You know, we don't need an excuse to get corn oil and soy oil and canola oil in there, the majority of which are genetically engineered. I saw in last week's paper that Monsanto has just been granted the right to come out with another genetically modified corn and soy species because the Roundup or glyphosate that has been used on plants has now created so many Roundup-resistant weeds, they have to use a more toxic pesticide. So when you're buying processed food and it's got soy oil, like the majority of salad dressings do, corn oil, like so many of the, you know, goodies for breakfast do, canola oil, oh, we thought that was really healthy. They're genetically modified, and therefore they've got glyphosate. And if you listen to No Nonsense Nutrition on a regular basis, you know glyphosate is one of the evil enemies. That residue of glyphosate that's showing up in the food, glyphosate is a chelator. It means it stops your ability to take up minerals. That's the way it kills the plant. You know, when you spray that stuff on your driveway to get rid of the weeds and the cracks, the way that it kills the plant is it chelates the minerals in there, especially the trace minerals, the things that you only need in micrograms, not milligrams. And when you chelate out the cobalt and the copper and the rest of these minerals, iron, etc., the organism can't survive. Why do I endorse organic? And don't tell me you can't afford organic. If I took all the soda pop and the chips out of your cart, you'd have plenty of money for organic. Besides which, there's lots of times when if you look at that list of the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15, which you can easily find on the EWG website, environmentalworkinggroup.org, or OCA, the Organic Consumers Association.org, go up on EWG, click on that link that says the Dirty Dozen. And it will take you to a chart that shows, actually, it's not the Dirty Dozen anymore. It's a Dirty 14, but that doesn't sound quite as good in a marketing standpoint. And the flip side of that chart is the Clean 15. The 15 fruits and vegetables that almost never have pesticide residue. I don't care if you ever buy an organic pineapple. I don't care if you ever buy an organic avocado. Because they very rarely have pesticide residues on it. But if you're talking about strawberries and peaches and bell peppers and potatoes and apples and spinach, darn right, you better be buying organic. When we get that glyphosate into our system, it's bioaccumulative. It increases in our body over time. We've only begun to see the problems that glyphosate causes. And if you're one of those people who bought into that cholesterol myth that you shouldn't eat bacon and you shouldn't have a pork chop and you shouldn't eat, you know, and it shouldn't eat eggs, I encourage you to eat more of nature's perfect food, eggs. You know, these 75 calorie nutrient bombs not only have all of the essential amino acids that we need, but they've got vitamins and minerals and great fats and brain protective antioxidants. We've made cholesterol the enemy for decades, but it's a fundamental component of every cell membrane in your body. And it's the precursor for all the steroid hormones in your body, including vitamin D. You know, if they discovered vitamin D today, they would have called it a hormone. They wouldn't have called it a vitamin. Eggs are associated with a 70% reduced risk of dementia in the elderly. 70%. Cholesterol is so vital for brain health that even though your brain only represents 2 or 3% of your whole body weight, 25% of all your cholesterol is in your brain. If you don't have enough cholesterol in your diet, your body will eat your brain. I know it sounds like a bad zombie movie, but it's fun to say. That current war on cholesterol, it seems like you can't drive it down low enough, is a mistake. And it's been a mistake for 40 years. But it's a multi-billion dollar mistake as far as the pharmaceutical companies are concerned. $5.2 billion worth of Lipitor alone last year. That's the last stat that I remember reading. If you want to pay attention to something in your blood work, you want to pay attention to hemoglobin A1C, HA1C. This is a snapshot of your average blood sugar level over the prior 3 months. It's not just what your glucose is when they pull the needle out of your arm. It's a longer-term picture, and what we know is the higher that number, the more your brain shrinks as you age. Remember, you don't want to put brain and atrophy in the same sentence. Uh-uh, honey. And so the higher that A1C number is, the more likely that your brain shrinks as you age. Yeah, some of it's going to happen. Some of it's going to happen anyway. But you can reduce the amount your brain shrinks by keeping your hemoglobin A1C low. When I had a client come in and say, well, I'm pre-diabetic, and I went, what's your A1C number? And he said 6.6. I said, you ain't no pre-anything, buddy. This isn't pre-diabetes. You're a diabetic. You don't have to get a blood sugar number of 126 and higher to be a diabetic. If you divide your HDL into your triglycerides and you get a number 4 or higher, you're diabetic. If your hemoglobin A1C is above 6, baby, you're already there. We don't want to see any 6s, much less any 7s, and certainly not any 10s. When we drive down that number by eating less carbs and eating more good fats, that's where the fish oil comes in. The fish oil changes the cell wall, and we need some saturated fat. We need that coconut oil. We need the organic butter. And boy, am I emphatic about organic when it comes to butter. Yeah, I know it's $5 a pound, but you know what? Butter is the medium that the federal government uses to determine how much pesticide your kid gets. So when you get organic butter, you're getting the right kind of saturated fats that help make up the cell wall. We need some of those saturated fats, but we don't need trans fats in the diet. Essential fatty acids? Yeah, we need them. Essential amino acids? Yeah, we need them. Essential carbohydrates? They don't exist. So when we begin to look at the opportunity that we have to change our future by changing our choices, start today. Yeah, it's hard. Yeah, it's hard because we're trained that this is how we're supposed to eat, that it's supposed to be a bagel for breakfast. But when we give up that slice of toast and that bowl of sugar bombs and that candy bar and the high fructose corn syrup, I mean, that is the single biggest source of calories in the American diet. Flour, gluten-containing flour, is 20% of all the calories. So no, it isn't automatic that when you give up gluten, you lose weight, but ultimately it'll happen. But it's this story about sugar in the brain that is really the issue that we want to talk about. It's understanding that surging the brain with sugar on a regular basis creates a tremendous amount of inflammation. And that inflammation is associated with cognitive function and greater decline. You know, I talk in my classes at the clinic about pushing disability as far into the future as possible. You know, frankly, I don't really care if you get Alzheimer's when you're 108. But if you've ever seen somebody with a neurological disorder, it doesn't make any difference whether they have Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS. In all of those instances, the proteins are deformed. This is what happened with mad cow disease. The proteins get deformed. And we know that that is connected to inflammation and that the inflammation can be connected to the nature of too many carbs. Because the sugars bind to the proteins. That's what hemoglobin A1C is measuring, glycolated proteins, where the sugars have hooked onto the proteins so they can't work right. And that discovery holds clues to more than brain disease. These shape-shifting proteins are what make our skin age fast. You know, I use 100% organic skincare products. But if what's true is that I'm creating these misfolded proteins in my system, my skin is going to age faster. Glycation is the biochemical term for when we bind sugar molecules to proteins or fats or amino acids. It's the same thing that happens on the surface of the bread when you put it in the oven. You know, all the dough looks alike, and then you cook it, and then there's crust on the top, and the inside is soft. Well, when you get those brown spots on your skin, that's the crust. They're called advanced glycation end products, AGEs. I mean, it's an appropriate way to relate AGEs because it makes us look aged. If you look at anybody who's prematurely aging, somebody with a lot of wrinkles, sagginess, discolored skin, just that loss of glow for their age. You know, look at a chain smoker. Chain smokers, their skin always looks yellowish. That's a hallmark of glycation. Smokers have a lot fewer antioxidants in their skin, and smoking increases the oxidation in their bodies and their skin, and they can't combat those byproducts of that process of glycation because they don't have enough antioxidants to overpower the volume of oxidation that takes place. And so when you look at somebody's skin, you're getting a pretty good picture of what's going on in the inside of their body at the same time. Make a better choice today. Have a little bit more protein. Have some good fats. And eat lots of non-starchy vegetables. Have the spinach and the green beans. Have the celery and the lettuce. Just make it fill up more of your plate. Begin to walk the way of a lower carb set of choices. Remember, if you put in plenty of corn and soy, whether it's genetically modified or not, you're going to do the same thing the cow does, and that's get you fat. Low carb. I don't know if paleo is the way, but I know lower carb is definitely a benefit. Until we come up with a single definition for paleo, I'm going to be hesitant to make that the word of the day. I just want you to lower the carbs overall, especially the ones that are processed. That's a place to start. You know, when you listen to No Nonsense Nutrition, you're listening to my opinions. They're not the opinions of the station, the management, the volunteers, the board. They're strictly mine, Eve Prang-Plews. I'm licensed by the Florida State Board of Medicine, and I hold the title of AFMCP. AFMCP means that I graduated from training in the clinical practice of functional medicine and am a certified practitioner by the Institute for Functional Medicine, a title I am proud to hold.